coming up on Philosophy Talk.
If killing is wrong, how can the death penalty be right?
I ask your forgiveness for what I've done. It was a terrible thing I've done, taking your son away from you. I hope my death gives you some relief.
Why shouldn't the state kill a justly convicted, sadistic murderer?
I just want to say, I think killing is wrong, no matter who does it, whether it's me or y'all or your government.
Capital punishment, state-sanctioned murder, or justified retribution?
Our guest, Robert Weisberg, director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center. The death penalty.
The ultimate punishment.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, capital punishment, that is, the death penalty. We'll start with some facts. Who practices the death penalty? What do they apply it to? Next, we'll consider some abstract philosophical arguments for and against the death penalty. And then, in the final segment of the show, we'll ask whether we can justly apply the death penalty in the United States in the situation that we face today. So, John, what do you think about the death penalty?
Ken, I'm a little embarrassed. I always like to pattern my thoughts after the great philosophers, David Hume, if possible. But I actually don't know what the great philosophers say about the death penalty. You must. You're a classically educated kind of guy.
I think you're just pretending. The great philosophers, like everybody, are kind of all over the map. I mean, lots of philosophers as diverse as Kant, who thinks, you know, the categorical imperative and all that, and Mill, who's a utilitarian, they disagree in a lot, but they agree that the death penalty is all right. And Thomas Aquinas, lots of philosophers support the death penalty. But there was a philosopher in 1767, Cesar Beccaria, who wrote an essay called On Crime and Punishment that got intellectuals all over Europe opposed to the death penalty. Actually influenced Thomas Jefferson to try and eliminate the death penalty in the early U.S.
Well, I knew I could count on you for this erudition, Ken. So, you know, I don't want to be opposed to both Kant and Hume and St. Thomas Aquinas, but I do have a distinction. It seems to me that you know, there's two kinds of discussions of the death penalty and whether it's justified or not that you're likely to hear in the philosophy commons room or the cafe. One has to do with kind of the ideal, in the ideal state. It's kind of a very abstract philosophical question. In the ideal state where everything works right, would the death penalty be justified? And the other is in the practical world, the world we actually live in with all its limitations and racism and expensive lawyers, is it a fair thing? Now, on the first question, the abstract philosophical question, I guess I don't really see any reason why a just state shouldn't include a provision for putting, say, sadistic serial killers who are guilty beyond the shadow of a doubt to death. I have no problem with that.
Well, one could argue with that point. I mean, I don't think it's as cut and dry, as philosophically cut and dry as you're saying, but I do see your point. But, you know, we don't live in such a world. I mean, what do you think about the world in which we actually live?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the world in which we actually live, although I think it has some very nice attributes. But when it comes to the death penalty, it's a pretty sad state of affairs. The state of California, the state of Illinois, all the states, Illinois in particular, the Innocence Project started there. Lots of convicted murderers on death row found not by DNA tests to have committed the crimes of which they were convicted. Not everyone gets a good lawyer. Those who get expensive lawyers usually don't get put to death for the same crimes others get put to death for. So I'm practically opposed. I don't think we have the level of justice in the United States to really be putting people to death. But I'm not philosophically opposed.
That's a good distinction, and our story arc is going to kind of reflect that, right? The abstract philosophical arguments and the practical real-world considerations, we're going to make them bump heads. But to get us started, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, she's going to take us close up and personal to some of those practical problems you mentioned. She talked to a former death row inmate who was released when DNA proved him innocent.
In 1982, 18-year-old Pamela K. Willis was found murdered in Oklahoma City. She was naked and had been stabbed and strangled. Curtis McCarty was an acquaintance of the victim. He became a suspect and 3 years later went to trial.
You'll forget that stuff you learned in junior high school quick. You know, about the court systems and all that. I thought that I was going to get a fair shake at it, and I didn't.
The prosecution relied on evidence and testimony from Oklahoma City police chemist Joyce Gilchrist, which later turned out to be falsified. McCarty's attorneys had prepared him for the worst.
But despite all that, when they said guilty, I almost fell out of the damn chair. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was bad enough that it ended up in court to begin with. But even then, the discrepancies and the just questions, general questions, red flags, as they say, were all over the place.
DNA evidence now shows Curtis McCarty did not murder Pamela K. Willis, but he was incarcerated for 21 years, including 16 on death row. McCarty lived through the executions of scores of other inmates, many of whom he had known for years.
Down there, it's not like they take you to another building or another facility or anything like that. It's right there. I mean, you ain't got to leave the quad. It's right there. It's kind of hard to be, you know, go back and watch The Simpsons or something when you know right over there, you can see the screens, and on the other side of those screens is the door. And they're in there.
He says on the day of an execution, the mood is somber.
Until right before the execution, and everybody starts beating on their toilets and kicking the doors and making as much racket as they can. I don't know how that got started, but it did. It's feeble, I know, but nobody ever really talks about it. I guess it's just a way to say goodbye to that person, like him or not.
One of those executed was Billy Fox. He had been McCarty's cellmate for more than a decade. McCarty was there when guards came to take Fox to his execution.
You know, when they come, they're coming. There ain't no saying no. You're going. And he stood on his own 2 feet, but he still had that look in his eyes when he was leaving, and it broke my heart. I couldn't stand it.
Shortly afterwards, the FBI began investigating Joyce Gilchrist, the police chemist whose testimony had helped convict McCarty. One of the 1,400 cases under scrutiny was that of Billy Fox.
I don't know, I guess we're raised to believe that when people in authority, in trusted positions, tell us that this man or woman over here is corrupt and it's okay to take their freedom and, you know, trust us, that we believe it.
Joyce Gilchrist was fired in 2001 for fraud and misconduct, but the results of the FBI investigation have not yet been published. Curtis McCarty hasn't received any compensation for the time he lost on death row.
There's no way to get that back. None. And the most satisfying outcome for me is never going to happen. And that's to see them wearing them orange suits and handcuffs, being paraded in front of the cameras. You're under arrest for what you did, and it'll never happen. Ever.
McCarty was released on May 11th, 2007. He plans to go back to school and try to pick up where he left off 22 years ago. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
Curtis McCarty was the 15th person in the United States to be exonerated by DNA evidence after serving time on death row. He received legal assistance and representation from the Innocence Project. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Robert Weisberg. He's professor of law from Stanford University, a frequent contributor to NPR, The New York Times, and Slate.com on death penalty issues. Robert, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Good morning. Thank you.
Robert, you're an expert on many aspects of the law. What drew you in particular to writing and thinking about the death penalty?
It's obviously the most compelling example of the state exerting power over the individual. But I'd also have to make a kind of historical point, and that is when I started getting involved in this stuff, when I started getting involved teaching criminal law and practicing some in the area of death penalty appeals, the major big legal and, one might say, philosophical questions about the death penalty were very much alive in the courts back in the 1970s and early 80s. Most of the cases that came before the Supreme Court and ultimately got decided by them were on very, very big issues about whether we would have the death penalty, about what kind of basic criteria and procedures were necessary for applying it. That's changed, but that was the time when I got involved.
Well, I kind of let me follow up on it, Bob. I mean, when I read crime novels by Agatha Christie or Simenon, which is my main knowledge of European jurisprudence, these are written back in the 30s and 40s, and the death penalty is accepted in Europe then. Matter of fact, it's kind of swift justice. Now there's this great divide where the Europeans think that the Americans are barbarians because we still have the death penalty, and they're just sure it's wrong. Well, how did this divide develop, and how did America end up being out on a limb about this?
The Western European countries with whom we episodically choose to compare ourselves slowly but surely gave up capital punishment anywhere between the 1950s and the 1970s. Britain did so in the early 1970s, I believe, although it hadn't been used for a long time. And although there was a period of constitutional revolution over the death penalty in the United States, it never quite went away, and it has come back. But in terms of why here and not there, a common perception about the kind of political sociology of it runs as follows. It is not the case that the average European, Joe Sixpack in France or Spain, is opposed to the death penalty, and is thereby opposite to our generic, you know, populist person of the people here in the United States. Rather, the people, who would represent a majority view in Western Europe may not be that much different from those in the U.S. It's rather the role of elites. Elite intellectuals oppose the death penalty both here and there. The difference seems to be that elite intellectuals play a greater role in that kind of political or criminal justice issue in Europe than here.
I read that. I read something like that, that Europe is not, the European polity isn't so much out of sync with the American polity. Do you buy that? I mean, you said that was a pop sociology view. I mean, is that right or wrong?
I wouldn't say pop. I mean, I don't think it's the subject of the most rigorous research, but I think there's something to it. But there's a, you might call a kind of indigeneity problem here. That is to say, it's less on the minds of Europeans, in part because they don't have it. They've been trained, in effect, simply by the facts of political life for the last 30 years, not to turn to the death penalty as an alternative. It's no longer part of the kind of political biochemistry.
So, okay, but I it does puzzle me sometimes why Americans are so, I mean, it waxes and wanes, but Americans are at times intense about the death penalty, either pro or con, but often pro. I mean, a politician who said, I want to get up and abolish the death penalty at certain times in our history, recent times, would just stand no chance anywhere. I mean, what makes us so passionate about this thing?
There are many strands of inquiry there, and we'd have to go back to a lot of criminological theories about the American crime rate more generally and American punishment more generally than the death penalty. And a lot of it has to do with, not very sophisticated history about the frontier and the so-called frontier mentality. A lot of it has to do with the powerful legacies of slavery and the unusual hold that Southern culture has even on Northern culture. To some extent, it shouldn't surprise us that we're that different from Europe, because one of the things we have tried to do for the last 200 years is to be very different from Europe.
Well, and we have that Second Amendment that really makes us a more violent society, or at least makes the expression of violence much more visible. I mean, I've heard people say, well, the death penalty is kind of the flip side of the Second Amendment. If you're going to have a society that's saturated with guns, then it's, you know, you're not going to be a very hospitable to, I mean, it's kind of tougher view of punishment in life altogether.
Well, the very complicated story of the Second Amendment, though, is related to those, frontier factors in many people's minds.
Well, let's take this up in a more detail in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing capital punishment with Robert Reisberg from Stanford University.
So what do you think? Capital punishment, just wrong, period, end of sentence? Or acceptable in theory but unjust in practice? Or just a plain good idea from both the philosophical and practical points of view. Give us a call. Tell us your thoughts. Call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917.
The death penalty, the practical and the philosophical side, when Philosophy Talk continues.
What did you bring me? Keep me from the gallows pole.
This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. We're talking about capital punishment. Does your state or country impose the death penalty? Do you approve?
I'm Ken Taylor. Tell us your thoughts. The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Robert Weisberg from Stanford University's Law School.
So, Robert, you said that when you got into this, these intense philosophical issues were really being adjudicated by the court, as well as practical issues. But tell me, so let's imagine John's ideal society that's non-racist, non-elitist. It's got a fair system of justice. Tell me, philosophically, what do you think about the death penalty in that kind of context?
I'm going to be very evasive on that score. First, because I am very uncomfortable with encouraging people to express categorical views about the death penalty, at least to encourage them to do so too readily, because I think public perceptions about the death penalty and political perceptions are distorted too much by the tendency of people to line up automatically, I'm pro, I'm con, as if their positions represent some deep, authentic philosophical core.
But don't you think we don't you think it's important, though, to distinguish kind of the sort of intrinsic philosophical arguments pro and con about the sanctity of life, respect for life, you know, retributive theories of punishment. On the one hand, yeah. From, you know, applying these things in this real-world consideration and being able to separate out?
Absolutely. I think that one blurs into the other. And in the former category, I'd simply note that it is too easy, for example, for people claiming to be anti-death penalty to invoke mantras like sanctity of human life when they are not actually religious or when they are extremely inconsistent with respect to other issues related to life and death. And I think the same thing on the other side. So I think it is an important separation, but I don't think people pay their intellectual dues very often when they state their categorical positions.
To focus, let's imagine we're in a Rawlsian situation. We're behind a veil of ignorance. We don't know what our role is going to be in society, but three of us have been charged with designing society. And so we come up to the issue of the death penalty. And we say, what would the reasons be in favor of having a death penalty or not? Now, one reason in favor of it would be it's in the Bible, an eye for an eye. It's revenge. Is that an uncivilized view? Another view would be practical. Why pay 50,000 years to keep somebody in prison for the rest of their life when they've murdered a bunch of people?
I mean, if you start with this kind of, we're going to build society from ground up. That's a Rawlsian thing, right? And we don't know what role we're going to play. And that's the idea is supposed to be, since I don't know what role I'm going to play, I'm not building this society from ground up in a way that's self-interested.
Exactly.
It's just considerations of fairness, right? So let's look at abstract considerations of fairness. Here's the first thing I think you would want to say. Well, in this society, there's got to be mechanisms of punishment, right? There's got to be. I mean, people are going to violate the law and all that sort of stuff, and we need mechanisms of punishment. So you grant that. So punishment's okay. And then the next step is going to be, well, wait a minute. How does the punishment – what punishment for what crimes, right? And that's a little harder, right? Because you could think about that in at least two different ways.
And I do think that one of the dangers is people who express opposition to capital punishment at this high categorical level, making arguments that would almost carry in the direction of them opposing punishment. Just to get back to John's point, obviously some people don't like the notion of calling retributivist positions vengeance positions. Kant certainly wouldn't have. He would have said that, well, as Ken suggests, that there is a moral imperative in executing people who have murdered others simply because it is necessary to our very humanity that we do so.
I mean, you know, in many ways, it seems to me some of the things that Californians at least are totally happy with, like really long prison terms. Mm-hmm. There seems to be an odd feeling that you can take 10, 15, 20 years out of a person's life, and that's not such a big deal. They can get that for dope peddling. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine why just... What's the big categorical divide between death and just removal of freedom for one's entire life?
Listen, you're listening to Philosophy Talk, folks. We're talking about the death penalty with our guest, Robert Weisberg. We'd love to join this conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Let me just say one thing. I mean, so look, we said there's going to be punishment. We've got to make the punishment fit the crime, and that's kind of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, look, what punishment is determined by what good it will do us to punish people this way. So one argument for the death penalty is that it will deter of future killers, right? And that's a reasonable argument. That says the consequences of punishing people by death are that nobody else will kill, and that's cool. But something else you might think is that, you know, the punishment has to fit the crime. That is, the punishment has to be something you deserve. And what could death killing deserve except death? I mean, what's commensurate with the offense of killing except death itself? I mean, is there anything to say against that idea?
I'd simply note, by the way, that it's not exactly death. We're not supposed to be able to execute insane people who were insane at the time of execution. So in a sense, the punishment is not so much dying, but being forced to recognize why you're dying. I want to go back a bit to one or two other things. First of all, we're assuming that killing, as you use the term, is the crime for which we'd be imposing capital punishment. That's sort of true, wasn't true for most of American history, has been pretty much true for about 30 years now. But killing is a pretty ambiguous and vague term. There are very few homicides that qualify as the capital murders, which can lead to execution. Second thing I'd want to say is let's be very, very careful about the word deterrence. We're not really talking about deterrence. Nobody could say that capital punishment fails to deter if we're comparing a universe in which killers are capitally punished with a universe in which killers go free. It's a question of the marginal deterrent effect as compared to the effect of the next most serious penalty, right, which universally in the U.S. now is life without parole.
Let's let some callers in here. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And Ray in El Cerrito's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. You're Ray.
Hi there. Thank you. I had two comments. I'd like to know what your opinion was. The first is that... the problem I have with the death penalty is that it's not looking at it from the point of view of the criminal. These people are very bad people and deserve to be punished when they're convicted. And I'm sympathetic with the victims, but the larger issue is the integrity of the system. And can a government that has laws that are made by its government representatives really execute people very well when you have a king that just makes a decision where they don't really need law, they just need the whim of their... what they're thinking of today to do that.
Okay, right. I think that your question was, can a system of laws executed by fallible human beings, can it ever fairly impose the death penalty? What do you think about that, Robert?
It's very difficult to do, and the kind of embarrassing confusion and complexity of the doctrine of the death penalty in the United States is an example of that. We moved to a point about 30 years ago where we wanted to very much guide the discretion of juries and almost tell them when to execute and when not. That didn't work very well. We had to leave them more discretion. We came up with this somewhat oxymoronic thing called guided discretion, and it's not clear that we can ever truly guide discretion. Then, of course, you've got to get a little more historically or culturally situated than speaking in absolutely abstract terms. There's one fundamental social fact we have to deal with, which is racism in the United States. And we have probably succeeded in somewhat reducing the racially disproportionate effect of the death penalty in the United States, but not very much.
David in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Yeah, how are you? I'm interested in the aspect of bait and switch. And actually, I think you were talking about Europe and their propensity to avoid capital punishment. They're very familiar with the whole idea of princes and kings and tyrants instituting capital punishment to kill their political enemies. And where we in America have some idea of it's a remedy for injustice, just the very idea that a person could be locked away illegally and then executed, that really comes into it. So the bait and switch of it is the reason I called. And I can think of a clear example. Just recently, a prisoner on death row in Southern California, Tookie Williams, was actually one of the founders of the Crips. But he was, in his later years, as he was sitting on death row, he very much took remorse at what he had done, and he did a huge amount to teach both children and also Crips and Bloods and the other gangs to stop fighting and take part in society. And so when he was executed just in the last couple of years, Arnold had his opportunity to stop the execution and make sure that these gangs were not fighting among each other, but he actually went out of his way to politically execute someone, and now the rise of gangs has started to reemerge.
Well, that's a very good point, Dave, and it's an interesting problem. I mean, we seem to have stumbled on in America, and I think particularly in California, a really bizarre formula, which is you have the death penalty, you decide to put people to death, but then you have an appeals process that takes so long that by the time they're put to death, you're almost guaranteed that they will be, in terms of personality and characteristics, having been in prison all this time, they'll be significantly different. It's not clear you're even in some sense putting the same person to death. Yet if we didn't have all those appeals, where would the Innocence Project be? The whole thing does seem to be a bit of a philosophical quagmire.
What do you think, Robert?
You could take a kind of detached and wry look at it, and I think John was going in this direction, by saying that we have a kind of equilibrium, an optimal death penalty in California, and indeed in most of the United States. That is to say, we sentence enough people to death to keep the art form alive. We execute an occasional person, I guess, you know, to kind of fine-tune the artistry a little more. We don't execute enough people to arouse the kinds of anti-death penalty passion that might occur. We actually, perhaps not intentionally, fool people into thinking that we're using the death penalty far more often than we are, because people are just vaguely aware that the death penalty is out there and they think it's being used. But, so it's a kind of equilibrium.
But actually, I mean, this is an interesting philosophical point, because in a way, it kind of lets us have the best of both worlds.
Absolutely.
Right? Because one of the things, you know, Christians say against the death penalty is this thing about the sanctity of life everywhere. Life is always inviolable, and the murderer is still a person, right? And you might think, well, yeah, but the person has to be brought short. Well, putting somebody on death row with the prospect of death can really bring them short, and they can make them reflect and internal. And maybe if it lasts long enough, they'll own up to their guilt. They'll be deeply sorry. They'll have remorse, and then at some point you can offer them redemption, right? So maybe it's a, you know.
Can I say a word about Tookie Williams, whom the questioner mentioned? That was a hard one. It's actually perfectly legally okay to consider, when somebody's being sentenced to death, his behavior, change of personality, whatever, that occurs after the killing. That's simply the way the law has evolved. So it's not entirely about the moral desert captured in or before the moment of killing. Post-incarceration remorse is a factor. It didn't work for Tookie Williams, but it could have. Here's the problem I have with criticizing Schwarzenegger in this regard. The next person up on death row shortly after Tookie Williams was a pretty uninteresting, unsavory character who hadn't done a damn bit of good in his entire life and wasn't intellectually qualified like Tookie Williams was. Was Arnold supposed to spare Tookie and then execute the next guy? Then we get into the arbitrariness issue.
But it wouldn't be arbitrary, because one, in a way, deserved redemption and the other didn't. I mean, if redemption can be reserved through remorse and regret and reformation, then it doesn't...
But I didn't say that the second guy angrily protested his innocence or angrily justified his killing. He lacked certain intellectual and moral capacities that would have made him an attractively remorseful figure.
1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. Join our conversation. I think we have an email there. Gentleman in Menlo Park writes the following. I heard about a law in some states called felony murder, where you can get the death penalty for killing someone even if you were just an accomplice and didn't actually pull the trigger. How does the moral justification of the death penalty differ in these cases, Janet wonders.
The Supreme Court has actually taken up that issue. Most people who are sentenced to death in the United States commit an intentional or indeed premeditated killing. There is a category of felony murder where accomplices can be sentenced to death, but it's not exactly the case that they're innocent accidental accomplices. First of all, you may not pull the trigger, but you may be fully culpable for the act of the killing. Depends on how you're an accomplice. Second of all, the Supreme Court has said that if your murder charge arises in that way during the course of a felony with somebody else, you still can't be executed unless you exhibit this very, very subtle moral state called extreme indifference to human life. In other words, when you engaged in your actions, you may not have intended death, but you took actions whereby you knew there was a great unjustified risk of death, and you damn well did it anyway.
Elizabeth in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Elizabeth.
Thank you for taking my call. Gentlemen, you are philosophers, and not, as I can tell, religious people. Redemption is a religious term. Redemption cannot be earned. Perhaps you might use another term?
Well, I don't know. You don't think forgiveness can be earned? You don't think somebody can ever deserve forgiveness?
No.
Actually,
forgiveness is a gift from another person. Redemption is a gift from God.
Elizabeth, we did a show on forgiveness with Charles Griswold, who's recently published his book, and he disagrees with you, and I think I do too. I do think there is forgiveness that's a pure gift, but there's also when somebody is remorseful and you refuse to forgive them, and there's genuine remorse, Elizabeth. I think if you withhold forgiveness, there's something wrong with you.
Definitely. But that doesn't mean that it has been earned. You haven't done something to pull it out of the other person. If the other person cannot give forgiveness, cannot offer it freely, then definitely there is something wrong with it.
Elizabeth, you sound like you have a pretty sophisticated understanding of this. What is your religious point of view? I mean,
I'm a Protestant Christian.
Protestant Christian, okay.
And my elder son is a philosopher and a law student.
Terrific.
Well, let me ask you, as a Protestant Christian, are you opposed or in favor of the death penalty?
Well, that's such a slam dunk for me. I'm completely opposed to it.
On what grounds?
There is nothing that Jesus has taught us that says that we can take another life.
So we've got an email now along the same topic from Philippe. He says, you guys mentioned the biblical injunction, eye for an eye, and took it as an automatic prescription for the death penalty, but it should be understood as a statute of limitations, as it was common to kill an offender for a minor infraction. So they were saying, don't take more than an eye for less than an eye.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing capital punishment with Robert Weisberg from Stanford University.
So what do you think we should do with really vile murderers? Rehabilitate them, lock them up for life, or kill them?
Justifying the death penalty in present-day society, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Should we be sending people to the electric chair? Well, maybe that's not humane. How about lethal injection? Does that solve the moral problems? Or is all of this just morally bankrupt? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Robert Weisberg from Stanford University. Robert, you've been rubbing your nose in this stuff for a while. I mean, you're a practicing lawyer. You write about this stuff. So tell me the bottom line. You know the system. Is it just? I mean, I'm not talking about abstract philosophical justice, but do we do this in a way that's morally acceptable, defensible?
It doesn't work very well. First, ironically enough, in our effort to be more careful, and we have been successful in, I think, reducing, although not eliminating, the chances of an absolutely innocent person being executed, and we've probably drawn a circle around the most heinous killers in order to ensure that we don't kill somebody who perhaps was somewhat less culpable. We've actually so reduced the number of executions that it's not clear whether it's accomplishing very much at all, you know, in terms of, you know, social consequences. Second, even within the small arena in which death sentences and executions occur, the racism factor hasn't disappeared. Let's just be clear that there's been a lot of research on this and that people misperceive the nature of the alleged discrimination. If we're talking about the death penalty rather than criminal justice generally or society generally, the discrimination does not take the form of disproportionately executing minority or African-American killers. Rather, it's the disproportionate effect of killing people, executing people, who have killed white people rather than black people. That's where the discrimination occurs, and it hasn't gone away.
We have an email from Everett on House Court, and he says, I understand you can be executed for treason. Are there any other crimes other than murder for which you can be executed in the United States?
Well, first of all, nobody's been executed for treason in many decades. It still is out there as a hypothetical possibility. It has been the case since the death penalty was constitutionally restored in 1976 that everybody who's been executed has been executed for murder. The Supreme Court said in the late 70s that, for example, the crime of rape of an adult person that does not cause her death cannot be punished capitally. We're not sure about the breadth of that holding because it's just been in the last few years that a few states, most notably Louisiana very recently, has tried to put forward a death penalty law for the crime of, well, two instances of child rape where it does not cause the death of the victim. So we just don't know yet.
I want to ask you about the discrimination thing, because I read an article in which a pro-death penalty advocate said, well, people, that this disproportionate executing of people whose victims are white, that's more traceable than people admit to the fact that most killing is intra-racial. Right, so that most white killers kill whites, and most black
killers. That's simply not true. Because these are incredibly sophisticated multiple regression analyses, which take that into account. There's a more important point, though, here, and that is that if you're concerned about the discrimination aspect of the death penalty, in theory, you have to accept the possibility that the solution is far more executions rather than fewer executions. And if the idea was to ratchet things up to ensure equality in terms of race of the victim, for the very point you just mentioned, Ken, the way to avoid discrimination would be, in effect, to execute far more black killers.
Oh goodness! So I don't think I want to execute more of anybody. What would prevent us? I mean, why don't we just abolish this thing? I mean, it seems to me like the social cost of the death penalty, of enforcing it, especially with all these safeguards. I mean, death penalty. I've read time and time again that imposing the death penalty is much more expensive.
Yes, it is.
Than imposing life in prison.
Yes, it is. John threw out before the idea of, you know, spending all this on the prisoner. We know that although keeping a prisoner in prison for a long time is probably even more expensive than paying tuition, room and board at Stanford for 40 years. As presently constituted, our legal system costs us far more in the act of executing somebody than in keeping him in prison for 40 years. People then say, well, let's just eliminate those long appeals, blah, 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 blah. The fact is, it just turns out to be very hard to do in the American system.
If we eliminated those long appeals, then it seems to me that the death penalty imposition would be morally fraught in another way, because we would have fewer safeguards against executing the innocent.
Probably, although I simply want to stress that the unbelievable length of the appeals is a little hard to defend as well. In other words, it may well be that, you know, keeping people on death row for 20 or 30 years before they face the possibility of execution does protect us against wrongful executions, but it's a pretty crazy way to do
things. What's the average time on death row prior to execution?
10 years, I'd say.
Really? Wow, that is a long time.
Well, it is a long time. I generally think we should get rid of the death penalty in the U.S. I think that your point about Louisiana is interesting. I think the fact that we do have state governments that do have a lot of say over punishment makes a big difference with Europe, because you know, some of these are states that have traditions that are very much, you know, we have guns, and if If we don't like it, we shoot you.
Absolutely. And the Supreme Court has stepped in, drawing some lines. We now know you can't be executed if you are under 18 at the time you kill. You can't be executed if, by some reasonable measure, you were more mentally retarded at that point. But our system does not encourage the Supreme Court to intervene too much in state affairs, which means we get back to the political issue. And the question is, you know, with the crime rate pretty much down in the United States, although it's going up again a little, and the death penalty sort of off the political radar, it hasn't been an issue in the last few elections. So, maybe there'd be a tipping point. I don't know.
I'd like to go into my quasi-Nietzschean, Foucaultian mode, which in my old age I'm developing more and more. I mean, I want to ask the question, what do we get? Those who support the death penalty and prevent its abolition, what do they get out of having this thing? Especially as it's currently constituted. I mean, whose interest does it really serve, and what does it actually achieve? Not the abstract justifications, but what does it actually achieve?
Well, let me
anybody?
Throw out a kind of unsophisticated answer before we get a more sophisticated one. I mean, if we're going to have a state, you kind of have a Lockean state of nature thing. In the state of nature, the victims would have the right to kill the person who killed their son or daughter. Right now, if we're going to have a state and they're going to give that right up, the state has to kind of promise to do something appropriate. And a lot of people feel that victims, the victims' families really achieve some kind of peace when the person is eliminated otherwise.
That's a view about the state has to wreak justice. That's true of every European democracy and emerging democracies, that the state ought to do that. Right, so we all believe that. But now, what is it about Americans, or at least a significant chunk of Americans, that we're satisfied with this thing, that we want this thing? It can't just be abstract principles. It's got to be something deep in our psyche.
Ken talks about himself being an old-age Foucauldian. I'll try something different, being kind of a pop Kantian. I can't explain these roots in the frontier or American individualism or attacks on British hegemony, but I do think that the major motivation is a kind of political and popular self-conception, and it is somewhat self-reinforcing, indeed, especially in the face of the European difference.
Can you tell me just slightly more about what you mean by that? Briefly?
I think Americans enjoy believing that they live in a world where moral clarity is possible and where violence is met by violence in a manner which is morally comfortable.
I think that's illuminating.
We're frontier Kantians. That's a new category.
Yeah, that's very illuminating. On that illuminating note, Robert, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Robert Weisberg, professor of law at Stanford University, frequent contributor to NPR, The New York Times, and Slate.com on death penalty issues.
Ken, to get ready for this show, I know we both watched that great film with Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn, Dead Man Walking.
Yeah, it's a great flick. So let's take Philosophy Talk to the Movies and talk about it a bit.
Well, you know, in it, Sean Penn is a convicted murderer, part of a pair of guys that were convicted of a double murder and a rape. Susan Sarandon plays Sister Helen, a nun who, just as a result of a letter from the Sean Penn character, gets involved in the last few months and weeks and days and hours of his life.
And I just want you to know I'm here to listen, and whatever you want to talk about, that's fine.
You're very sincere.
What do you mean?
You never done this before?
No.
Never been this close to a murderer before?
Not that I know of.
It's a very moving film, but in 1995 when it came out, and again when I saw it for this show, I wasn't quite moved the way that most of the reviewers and the press suggested I should be. I didn't see it as a powerful anti-death penalty statement. None of the usual reasons against the death penalty that I find acceptable and quite reasonable applied in this case. His innocence or guilt really wasn't uncertain. There was some uncertainty as to whether he pulled the trigger, but he was involved enough to convict for murder. Racism was clearly part of the political process, but not part of this particular case. And the period between sentencing and execution hadn't been so long that they were basically dealing with a different person. So given the very moving depiction of the murder and the complete lack of dignity with which those people were given death by Sean Penn and his confederate, my reaction was, well, this seems like a case where the death penalty makes a lot of sense.
John, I mean, you have a point, but I actually think that shows something about how powerful and ambitious this movie really is. I mean, because Tim Robbins, who wrote and directed Dead Man Walking, took the hardest possible case for an anti-death penalty argument, I think, because there's this scene in which the Sean Penn character is coming on to Susan Sarandon's sister, Helen.
I like being alone with you. You're looking real good to me.
Look at you. Death is breathing down your neck. You're playing your little mad on the make games. I'm not here for your amusement, Matthew. Show some respect.
Why should I respect you? Because you're a nun, you with that little cross around your neck?
Because I'm a person. Every person deserves respect.
And I think the movie's trying to make the point that the creature that we're putting to death in this ritualized, I think still brutal way, it is trying to say to us, is still a person. And the personhood of that person still deserves, even when it's like this awful personhood, still deserves respect. Remember when he's going to go before the clemency board and the attorney says, well, it's easy to kill a monster. It's hard to kill a person.
All we have to do is to present you as a person, a human being, and convince them to spare your life.
What we have to do is prove I'm innocent.
We're getting to that. We're filing appeals with the federal court, the Supreme Court, but this is the pardon board. I don't mean a thing to them whether you pulled the trigger or not. They're going to be thinking of the crime and of you as a monster.
And I think they lose the argument, right? And that's kind of your side of the thing. You know, that you can root for the side of the state that says, yeah, we recognize this as a person and not a monster. We're not merely pretending to see the person in him. We really do see the person in him. But nonetheless, we're going to take his life. And we do that with full justice. Your side is represented there in this movie, Dead Man Walking.
Well, I think the movie makes that point well. But the question is, does this being convinced that he deserves dignity because he's a person translate into being against the death penalty? Now, maybe I'm just perverse, but what came to me is even in this situation, in a Louisiana prison, there is a lot of attempt to give him dignity. There's Sister Helen's whole involvement. There's the involvement of the priest, who's a little bit less sensitive than Sister Helen, but who obviously, from his perspective, cares a lot for Sean Penn's soul.
This boy is to be executed in 6 days and is in dire need of redemption. Are you up to this?
I don't know, Father. I hope so. I've been praying for guidance.
You can save this boy by getting him to receive the sacraments of the church before he dies.
There's the fact that he's given a chance for last words and last rites. So compared to the death that he visited on his victims, he does have death with a considerable amount of dignity.
But I think it does juxtapose that argument with another argument, and that's an argument about redemption and forgiveness. So the boy's father, toward the end of the movie, after Sean Penn's character Matthew Poncelet has been put to death, the father shows up at the funeral, and he says to Sister Helen, I don't know why I'm here.
I got a lot of hate. I don't have your faith.
Oh, it's not faith. I wish it were that easy. It's work.
What's work? The work of trying to achieve reconciliation and forgiveness is really hard work. You remember a couple years ago, we had a show on forgiveness with Charles Griswold, and he made this kind of point, right? I mean, forgiveness is pointless if the perpetrator never reaches that stage of remorse and regret. But once the perpetrator reaches this stage of deep remorse, then forgiveness can be an amazingly transcendent act. And I think that's part of the message. Are you at all moved by the argument, the Christian argument, that redemption and forgiveness are kind of higher moral principles that kind of transcend that?
I'm moved by practically anything, Ken, including those points, but we probably need to explore that in a different show.
I think you're right.
This has been Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies. We've been talking about Dead Man Walking, directed by Tim Robbins, starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone.
Philosophy Talk is sponsored in part by Powell's City of Books.
On the web at powells.com.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.